I'm not a gag man.
I think you're a pretty funny man.
Yeah, but I'm off the cuff, you know? Like, I take it as it comes. I'm no writer. You don't want to give me a responsibility.
Oh, how dare I?
That's the worst thing.
Expect a parent of two to have responsibility.
I cash all my responsibility chips during the week when I'm just trying to keep the kids from dying. And then
That's fair. That's very fair. And this is stranger still. I'm going to use that. Stranger Still, a podcast where we answer the questions you never thought to ask. Normally, there'd be another voice across from me at my desk to interrupt me and say, like, oh, it's the questions you never questioned a question or something stupid like that. But he is out of town. He's going back home, which is exciting for him. But I was a bad planner and I forgot he was going to be out of town. So I have someone to save us. Don't worry, it's not just me. I have the host of the Deep in Bear Country podcast, Click It Cast, and it's Del Toro time, which is appropriately themed for today's episode. Please welcome Phil Gonzalez.
I am so happy to be here.
I am happy to have you.
Now, do you guys usually actually sit across the desk from one another?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, wow. So you guys are just actually in the same room, huh?
Yeah. I get to stare deeply into his colored eyes that I don't know what color they are, despite looking at them every week.
His face is his face is one of the greatest mysteries. One of these days, you're going to have to cover that in its own episode. What color are your beautiful eyes?
I have John face blindness, unfortunately.
Do you not recognize him if you run into him outside the studio?
I don't. Actually, I did run into him once. I don't know if we told this story on the podcast, but I ran into him at the post office as I was embarrassingly trying to buy Scooby-Doo stamps, and they didn't have them. And it became this whole ordeal where everyone in the post office heard that I was trying to buy Scooby-Doo stamps. And as I was walking out, John's like, Nick Wood? I was like, oh, God, who is it? Who saw me? But at least it was John, and he knows I'm obsessed with Scooby-Doo. So,
but it's the post office, so they now know where you live.
Mm-hmm.
They know what you get in the mail and everything.
Yeah, so they got the deep web on me.
Plus, you were going to send mail with Scooby-Doo stamps on it. Like,
yeah.
At some point, people were going to know you had purchased Scooby-Doo stamps. This was not going to be a secret for the rest of your life.
That's true.
Unless you're like a philatelist and you, like, collect stamps. Do you collect stamps?
I collect Scooby-Doo.
That's true.
We've already gone off the rails, and that is A-okay. But Phil, before we start today, I was hoping you could tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the podcast that you do.
I am Phil Gonzalez. I live in Minnesota, so just north of you, close enough to you that we have actually had lunch together,
yeah.
Which was brilliant and beautiful.
And delicious.
In fact, when I told Alana I was going to be doing this show, she was like, whose show is that again? I was like, oh, that's Nick Wood. And she was like, hooray. She was so happy. She likes you and your family a lot.
I like your family.
Well, thank you very much. So I have three podcasts, one that I do by myself with guests called Deep in Bear Country. It's a podcast about the Berenstain Bears. Mm-hmm. If you follow the Best of Next Door on Twitter, you might have heard of me because I tend to pop up on there every so often.
And it's lovely every time it does.
It is amazing every time it happens. I also have a podcast called Click It Cast that I co-host with John McCoy, where we go over the books of Beverly Cleary's career.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I do a podcast with my teenager, Ollie, called It's Del Toro Time, where we covered the works of Guillermo del Toro. And now we are covering all the movies that he has listed as his greatest influences in chronological order.
Yes.
Yes.
Most of them are horror movies, correct? There's not like a romantic comedy that...
Well, we do. He also is a big fan of like Preston Sturges.
Okay.
So we get these like Preston Sturges movies every so often where it's like there's no horror. It's all like comedy and social commentary. So there are like... He is a well-rounded man. So his Good. Influences are all over the place, but definitely a lot of horror, psychological horror, thrillers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot that influenced the man's artistic background.
Yeah, he's a good filmmaker. I love his movies. I still haven't seen his newest one, Shape of Water. Yeah.
Oh, get on that.
I know. Having a two-year-old is hard. That's my excuse. But the reason I keep bringing that up is because I think it is perfect for today's episode. I would find it hard to imagine that any movies we'll talk about today are ones that you have covered. However, we are going to be covering... I've got five serial killers that have inspired horror movies. Mm-hmm. Some of them are... I think the oldest one we have is in the 70s up until like 2008. And there's a lot more out there. I could have chosen a lot to cover, but I narrowed it down to five, and I wanted to stay away from biopics and stick to like fictional stories that where writers like heard about this serial killer and then wrote a movie about that scenario, not specifically like this is a movie about Ed Gein.
Right.
Because that's too obvious. Then I'm just telling you the story of Ed Gein, which I'm going to do anyway, but, we'll get into those guys. In some cases, what the serial killer did in the movie was way worse than what he did in real life. And sometimes the real life serial killer was way worse. And I think that's pretty interesting, but I'll let our listeners decide that for themselves. And one final warning, this episode might be kind of gross. Mm-hmm. I've tried to PG-ify it as much as I can, but there'll be an unfortunate amount of violence towards women, murder in general, decapitation.
Yeah, I was going to say, you can only PG the story of Ed Gein down so far.
Yes, and there's four more that are pretty just as bad as Ed Gein, but I'll try to give a heads up when like the bad stuff is coming just so our listeners can skip ahead. I'll run through the five serial killers for our listeners. We've got Ed Gein, we've got Joe Ball, we've got Daniel Harold Rowling, we've got Alexander Sawney Bean, and the Charles Manson cult. Before I started researching, I'd only ever heard of Ed Gein and Charles Manson.
Ah.
Have you ever heard of any of these other names that I listed?
Oh, I'm very familiar with all of them.
Is that healthy?
Well, I hope that we have time to talk about the whole, I would say, the serial killer interest has definitely peaked in the last few years.
Oh, yeah.
Like, above and beyond, serial killer biopics and serial killer, especially podcasts.
Right, true crime podcasts, yep.
Yeah, it's become, when I was a young man, and, you know, I think, serial killer interest kind of starts when you're a teenager. It's that whole, oh, my gosh, terrible things have happened in this world.
Yeah.
And people have studied it, and it's kind of like you graduate from dinosaurs, which you couldn't believe existed when you were a kid, into serial killers, which you can't believe you exist when you're a teenager. But it used to be if you wanted to know about serial killers, you had to go to the public library and get books. I mean, I have a shelf of books. Gosh, are they still here? Yes. And looking behind me, I'm at work, and on my bookshelf, I've got several Harold Schechter books, maybe even the one about Ed Gein.
Really?
Right behind me at work, just because I used to loan them out. I used to just buy every book I could find because it was just...
They're fascinating.
But now it's just everywhere. The knowledge is just everywhere. You just jump online, you do a quick search, and boom, you can know about these... sort of these weird, strange artifacts of American, mostly American, but worldwide crime history.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I should point out we're only talking about American serial killers because that's all I came across. Actually, no, that's not true. I immediately rescind that. we have one who lived in Scotland, I believe.
Scotland, right. But he may or may not be legendary.
Exactly. And we'll get there because that one's that's really interesting. But I wanted to start off with one of the more famous serial killers out there, and that is Ed Gein. He's inspired a lot of films. And I don't know if that's because he's so famous or because it happened quite a while ago. And this is probably the grossest and longest history that we'll talk about in today's episode. But... the year is 1906, and we're in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is a little too close to the both of us for my comfort. but a baby by the name of Edward Theodore Gein is born. And when he was nine, his family kind of picked up and moved to a farm where he'd go to kind of spend the rest of his days as a free man in isolation on this farm in Plainsville, Wisconsin. And the only people he had around him were his mom, his dad, and his older brother. And the only other time that he interacted with other people was when he went to school. So he was really isolated, I would say socially stunted. I don't know if that's the right word. But throughout his upbringing, his mom was incredibly religious and apparently ran the house. His dad was very timid and alcoholic, reportedly. And his mother would preach that women and lust were the root of all evil. So if you ever felt lust within your heart, it was the devil trying to get at you. And that, I think, Ed started to develop a detachment from women. And his father died when he was 34. And at this time, Ed was tasked with odd jobs around the town to help support his family. And then 4 years later, his brother mysteriously died in a brush fire.
Very mysteriously died in a brush fire.
Well, please expand on that, because I didn't get like any explanation as to why everyone said mysterious.
Because he goes out, he and his brother had been kind of on the outs, and his brother was, so Ed was the mama's boy.
Yeah.
Like in every sense of the word, like he doted on his mother. He loved his mother. He was obsessed with his mother, as we will get to.
Exactly.
And Ed's brother wasn't, and was extremely critical of their mother. And it's reported that, he would insult the mother. He would talk about just like what an overbearing woman she was. And then one day Ed goes out with his brother to go work out in the fields and comes running back, and he's like, "Uh-oh, there's a fire. I don't know where my brother is." And when they find his brother, he's dead, and they're like, "Well, I guess he must have died in the fire." But there's strong, I wouldn't say strong evidence, but there's a strong undercurrent of belief that Ed might have murdered his brother out.
He is involved.
And then covered it up with this mysterious fire.
Huh. Well, that might have been the beginning of some terrible behavior, but it wasn't until a year later that his mom actually died from health issues, just like normal health issues. That's where I kind of thought the psychosis set in, but maybe it started a little bit earlier with his dad talking, or not his dad, his brother talking.
Smack.
I couldn't think of them talking smack about his mom. But after his mom died, he was living by himself at the age of 39. Like I said, he was socially stunted from being in isolation so long, and no one really ever came to check on him. And finally, in 1954, a local barmaid by the name of Mary Hogan went missing. And up until about 3 years later, that disappearance was unsolved. And in 1957, Bernice Warden went missing. And she worked at a hardware store, and there was a bloody trail leading out of the hardware store. And her son worked for the sheriff's department. And I didn't really get the details as to why, but he suspected Ed Gein of her disappearance.
Well, they talked to people, and people were like, Ed Gein was the last person we saw in the store with her. He was buying antifreeze. And then they checked the receipts, and the last sale on the receipts made from the store was to Ed Gein for antifreeze.
Got it.
And they were like, oh, Ed Gein probably killed. Like, it was just basically just like, well, there's a bloody trail. The last person in here was Ed Gein.
Yeah.
We know he's a little strange. Let's go investigate.
He's not going to put too much effort into covering his tracks. But they did track him down at a neighbor's house, and at that time apprehended him. And they made a trip out to the farm, and they showed up, and they found a lot of human body parts. And there's
a whole lot.
There's a whole list of everything that they found on Wikipedia. So if you want to check that out, I would go check that out yourself. But I kind of pared it down. If you're easily queased out, skip ahead like 15 seconds, because they found human bones, just a whole array of human bones, leatherized human skin covering things like trash cans, chairs. He made a corset. He made a belt out of nipples. He made a little girl's dress. He made leggings, a window shade, drawstrings from lips, and a lampshade. There's several skulls, just like so many skulls. Some of them were fashioned into bowls. They found four noses, fingernails from a female, and a partridge in a pear tree.
Oh yes. many of these pieces were pieces from the two women that were previously mentioned.
Yeah.
But not all of them.
Not all of them. The most famous thing that they found was a skin suit made out of his mom's skin, and I assume other women, because you can't make a full suit out of just one decaying person. But he wanted to be able to step into his mother's skin and become his mother. Because he had this really strange relationship, as you had alluded to, with his mother.
Yeah.
So ultimately, he was only convicted of the two murders of Mary and Bernice, but they found the remains of 10 female bodies on his property. It turns out that he admitted to successfully grave robbing 9 different women's graves. I believe he made 40 trips to the graveyard, but only like 10 of the trips were successful, and then he came out with different parts of 9 different women. So he'd exhume the bodies, and then he would violate them, he would mutilate them, and he would, in some cases, decapitate them and keep their body parts. Am I missing anything on Ed Gein?
I think you just about covered it. I think the big takeaway from the actual story of Ed Gein was that he was more a ghoul than a killer. I mean, he killed two people, but the big thing was that he dug up graves and he turned these dead bodies into everyday items, specifically that woman's suit.
Yes, which is just horrible. Mm-hmm. So when you hear a woman's suit, what movie do you think of, Phil?
I mean, women wear suits in a lot of movies. I think of Working Girl. That's a big one with women in suits.
Prada.
Broadcast News. There's some power suits in that. So many movies, actually. Why do you ask?
How about movies where someone has a suit made out of women's skin?
Oh, well. Yeah, so you're looking at the Silence of the Lambs connection.
That is correct. If people haven't watched Silence of the Lambs, I just watched it today for the first time in preparation for this.
Oh, you had never seen it before?
There's a lot of classics that I've missed out on.
Oh, wow.
I own a lot of classics. I just haven't sat down to watch them. My wife hates scary movies, so I have to
I
have to find the time to watch them. But he was one of three people to inspire Buffalo Bill in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Buffalo Bill kind of borrowed from other people, too. Like, his MO was that he would look helpless to lure women in, and then when they helped him, he would kidnap them. That was taken from Ted Bundy. So, like, in the movie, you'll see Buffalo Bill in a cast trying to move a chair into his van. That's something that Ted Bundy did as well. He wore cast to look vulnerable. And then there was Gary Michael Heidnik, who kept women locked in his basement, much like Buffalo Bill did. But the main inspiration for the skin suit was from Ed Gein. There's a couple other movies that he inspired, too. Do you happen to know those as well?
Let's see. Ed Gein loosely inspired the novel Psycho, which became
Correct.
The movie Psycho, you may have heard of. It also became the movie Psycho, directed by Gus Van Sant, the remake from the late 90s.
The shot for shot remake.
Yeah. We don't talk about that one. And also, different aspects. So that was one aspect of the Ed Gein story, which was the mother aspect of it. The skin suit and skin, like, let's desecrate graves and build things out of the bodies aspect of it went on to inspire aspects of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Correct. I think it's kind of obvious to see how he inspired Leatherface when you go on to explain that he made lampshades and
yes.
chair covers out of human leather. But yes, 3 for 3, Phil. Good job.
Psycho, I mean, it's interesting because Psycho definitely delves much further into the psychology of a person so obsessed with their own mother that they become a killer in her stead. And it's a lot of the, because Ed Gein's mother was, you know, painted all women as evil, and Ed sort of took that into himself. All women were sort of worthy of destruction, but also you have to worship your mother and so much so that you want to become her. It's that internal battle that I think Robert Bloch did so well in the novel, and that Alfred Hitchcock and Anthony Perkins portrayed so well in the movie, which is just this person who is just dangerously conflicted inside.
Yes. It's still unnerving to this day, because Psycho is one that I saw a long time ago when I was way too young, and I was afraid of motels for a long time. Like, through 8th grade, I was afraid of motels.
Uh-huh.
But I also watched it again today, in preparation for this.
You had a busy day.
I did. I watched a lot of horror movies. And after I watched Psycho, I went to go take a shower, and horror movies don't usually scare me, but you know I locked that bathroom door.
You're just like that I always feel like somebody's watching me song. Where he says in the classic vein of that song, the lyrics, when I'm in the shower, I'm afraid to wash my hair, I might open my eyes and find someone standing there.
Yeah, it's terrifying. that was my life for a really long time. But yeah, so Psycho really focused on like the main character from, I forget his name, Norman Bates literally becomes his mother by the end of the movie. So it takes that to a whole new level. Should we move on to a shorter one that I got for you here?
Oh, what do we got?
Let's talk about Joe Ball.
Good old Joe Ball.
Also, a.k.a. the Alligator Man, a.k.a. Bluebeard South Texas.
Yes.
Now, had you heard of this man? Because I know that you used to reside in Texas.
I am from the Houston area. Mm-hmm. Joe Ball is, he's one of those Texas... It's a Texas story. Like everyone, I mean, I won't say that like I grew up hearing tales of Joe Ball, but as I got older and I was like, I wonder what famous like killers are from Texas. Mm-hmm. Because when I think of serial killers, I think of Wisconsin. I think of the Midwest because the Midwest is so isolated.
Exactly. It's a very Midwest thing.
Texas has the benefit of being so vast that just the thing about Texas is you drive across Texas and I've driven across Texas many times. There is so much nothing there. Mm-hmm. And then you suddenly hit these small towns, like Joe Ball's town of Elmendorf.
Yes. Very tiny.
Which was famous for being a speed trap once upon a time. These like little towns that are nothing except for an excuse to get tickets for the local constabulary.
Yes.
And Joe Ball was sort of this crime figure as the man who fed women to his pet alligators is how he was always framed.
Yes. And I don't know how true this is, but in my reading, it kind of sounded like some people think he's a myth or a legend and he didn't actually exist, but he did exist.
He definitely existed.
Yeah. But I didn't know if he had become like an urban legend, like King Arthur is, where people argue over whether he existed or not. Of course, it's more recent than that, so we can prove it. But
right, I think this is one of those stories where in the few, it kind of ties into what's coming up with the Sawney Bean thing, where there might one day his story, like if humanity survives the next few hundred years. Mm-hmm. The story of Joe Ball might morph into something greater.
He killed 1,000 women with 10 million alligators.
Right, his army of gators that he would rove across Texas devouring women.
If you looked at him wrong, he'd stick an alligator on you.
Right.
but Joe Ball, I'll zip right through this story because there's actually not a whole lot to it. Joe Ball, during Prohibition, he made a living smuggling alcohol. And then after Prohibition, he opened up a tavern called the Sociable Inn in Elmendorf, Texas.
That sounds very nice.
Yeah, it does. It sounds welcoming and trustworthy.
And sociable.
And sociable. It had two bedrooms in the back, and then there was a bar up front and an alligator pit in the back. And some nights, they'd get drunk, and he would let his guests pay to throw, like, stray cats and dogs into the alligator pit and watch them get eaten, which is egregious in and of itself.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
Yeah. But people around him, such as waitresses, for just a random example, would go missing, and he'd make up excuses for their disappearance, like saying, oh, they're in the hospital, and they got pregnant, didn't want anyone to know about it, or stuff like that. One day, I believe it was his girlfriend, he drank a little bit too much, went to the beach with her, and said, I took one of the waitresses down here and killed her.
Yeah.
So a sheriff caught wind of that, showed up and started questioning him, and Joe had like a hidden handgun that he shot himself in the heart with when the sheriff showed up, killing himself. And so because of that, we don't really know how many people he killed, but the sheriff caught up with one of his business partners who admitted to helping get rid of two bodies. And if you haven't guessed by now, dear listener, how he disposed of the bodies, he threw them in the alligator pit. So most estimates put him at about 20 people he killed or 25-ish, but no one really knows.
So I'm going to jump in now.
Yes, please.
And let the listeners know the real story.
Uh-oh. Because, did I get it wrong?
Okay. There, what you reported is what a lot of people believe.
Oh, but, my God.
In 2002, there was an article in Texas Monthly about Joe Ball.
Yeah.
And Michael Hall, the journalist, actually went to Elmendorf to talk with the citizens, with people, like, what happened? Like, what actually happened with Joe Ball? And it's available online. It's an incredible bit of, like, I'm going to deep dive into what is essentially an urban legend.
Uh-huh. Well, obviously.
And one of the most fascinating aspects of this is that Joe Ball, his family, the Balls, were the founders of this city.
Yeah.
They were a well-known family. He was well-connected. They were well-off. Mm-hmm. The Balls, like, if you go to the cemetery in town, it's all, as he says, it's like all Balls, like, as far as the eye can see.
That's, taken out of context, that's kind of funny.
And that Joe Ball, when you stopped in your story, you said, how did he dispose of those women? Uh-huh. I almost jumped in and said, he buried them.
Did he bury them?
Yes. They found the bodies.
He
just buried the women. So what happened was three women actually disappeared, but they ended up finding the third. She had moved. He was like, oh no, she moved. Yeah. And everyone was like, I bet he killed her. And then they're like, no, actually she moved. She left town. His business partner was actually an African-American gentleman who was a kind of his servant, who was forced to do a lot of, like, dirty work for him.
Like getting rid of bodies?
There was never any proof that Joe Ball ever put anything in that alligator pit besides animals.
Oh.
Like, they never found any human remains in the alligator pit. Now, granted, this was decades and decades ago, so there was no, like, DNA, but they never found...
You still find bones.
They never found human bones. They never found anything.
Yeah.
And what a lot of the townspeople say is they're like, well, yeah, a lot of his barmaids disappeared. But this is Elmendorf, Texas.
It's kind of
everybody disappeared. This is a town of literally 600 people.
People are itching to get out.
You didn't stick around Elmendorf, Texas.
Yeah.
You came in, you worked an odd job, you ran off, you got pregnant, you went to San Antonio. Like, San Antonio was just a hop, skip, and a jump away. Mm-hmm. You moved to the city. Like, you didn't stay in Elmendorf. So disappearing from a town of 600 isn't actually noticeable, because a lot of people were transients. But he talked to some people who were like, yeah, these women were no good. Like, they were no good. Like, there's this extreme anti-sex worker slant in a lot of their talk.
Really?
So you do get the feeling that they considered a lot of these women to be sex workers, whether or not they were, and that the town people didn't care if anything happened to them anyway. So you have that aspect of it. Well, I find the alligator aspect of Joe Ball's story the least interesting part. What I find interesting is the town surrounding him and the Ball family and the sort of weirdness of small town Texas life. Like, to me, this is as close to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre as you get. Because it's just this insular community with, like, disappearing people.
Now that you explain the whole story, because I'm on the outside of it, I'm way more fascinated that this legend has already propagated so far.
Yes.
That I read well-sourced articles and they miss out on the most important part of it.
I think it's fascinating.
That's
I love how legends build.
That's a really good... I don't know how we would do an episode on that. We'll come back to it another day. How do legends get formed?
Well, one of the way legends get formed is people start making fictional movies based off of them.
That's true. And what movie did Joe Ball inspire? Or the story of Joe Ball?
The story, the quote-unquote story of quote-unquote Joe Ball, quote-unquote inspired, Eaten Alive by Toby Hooper.
In 1977, if I can speak correctly. Have you seen this movie?
I saw Eaten Alive probably when I was, like, in high school, junior high. It's one of those movies that if you see the box art, you're like, oh, that movie. Like, it's a very famous poster.
Uh-huh. I haven't seen it. I might have to.
Yeah,
I heard it's like really campy and
it's
very
Toby
70s.
Hooper, so it's got that. He was coming off of Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
mm-hmm.
And so it kind of has that gritty, almost documentary feel to it. Like it's very, you know, we're going to focus on this, the sort of like the low lives and like the low life victims. And you get to see a very young Robert Englund in the very first scene, abusing a sex worker. It's a very difficult scene to watch. And you get to see Robert Englund basically playing a scumbag bad guy who basically his actions kick off the plot. He upsets a woman. It's like she's a young sex worker, and she ends up refusing him because he wants her to do things that she's not comfortable with. So the madam kicks her out, and she ends up coming across the alligator farm where women disappear.
That's a bad place to be.
If
you ask me. That's just my opinion. I'll have to check it out. But should we move on to our next one?
So Eaten Alive takes the skeleton of the legend and turns it into a guy. I think it was even said in, like, is it said in Florida, if I remember correctly?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Yeah, a guy in a swamp with an alligator farm who feeds women to his pet alligator, who's like his best friend. And in the end, I won't give away the ending, but it's not at all like Joe. He doesn't shoot himself in the heart. I'll just let you.
So it's very fictionalized.
Well, but it keeps that legend alive because people hear,
which is the most fascinating part.
Yeah, they're like, this is based on a true story. This is based on a real guy. Just like Texas Chainsaw Massacre was supposed to be based on a true story as well. And that just propagates that legend.
Yeah, I would say, I don't think Ed Gein was as bad as Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I think that that's not true.
Well, because he, like, affected real people.
Right. It's not a fictional story. should we move on to our next guy?
Yeah.
I've got Daniel Harold Rowling. Have you heard of him?
Danny Rowling. Yep. Great. As he's known as the Gainesville Ripper.
That's exactly
right. This guy was... Can I just editorialize for, like, 30 seconds?
Absolutely.
Serial killers are losers. They are, like, society's... People tend to, like, we tend to think that, like, they get put up on this pedestal as, like, the bad guys of American history. And, like, they're, like, comic book supervillains. Almost every serial killer that you've heard of is one of society's just – they are scumbags and losers. Like, the only reason they get away with what they get away with is dumb luck. They aren't super geniuses. They aren't masterminds. They aren't smarter than the cops. It's usually just the fact that they're killing people who aren't connected, so it takes the police a long time to put the pieces together. That's it. They are not anything big. And Danny Rowling is one of the prime examples. The poor guy had a terrible childhood, I admit. Terrible childhood. But he went on, as he said after he was arrested, he did this because he wanted to be as famous as Ted Bundy. He wanted to be the next Ted Bundy.
Which is a horrible thing to say.
Right.
If you're in that point in your life, you need to go see somebody.
Please see somebody.
You're exactly right. And as we've already kind of seen, these people also go unnoticed just because they are losers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just what they are. So we'll dive into Daniel Harold Rowling. He was born in 1957 in Louisiana to his mother, Claudia, and his abusive father, James. James worked for the police force and would verbally and physically abuse Daniel. So like you said, he didn't have a good childhood.
Yeah.
At some point, I didn't get an exact year for this. They moved to Gainesville, Florida. He did poorly in school. He was arrested several times throughout his teenage years for just burglaries and assaults. The serial killer side of him seems to start poking out in May of 1990, where he got into sort of a scrap with his dad. He pulled a gun on him, shot him, and Danny pulled a gun on his dad, shot him, and then ran away. His dad survived, but he lost one of his eyes and one of his ears. And then 3 months later, he went on a killing spree, which got him the name the Gainesville Ripper.
Yeah.
Because in the end, he killed 5 college students, 8 people total. Only one of his victims was male. The rest were female. And all of the women fit a profile. They were all petite, brunette-haired women with brown eyes. And his MO was... So he'd been arrested for several, like, break-ins and burglaries and stuff. And his MO here throughout his spree was that he would break into someone's house, usually at night when they're presumably sleeping. And if they were, he'd cover their mouth with duct tape and maybe bind their hands and stab them. Usually he would egregiously stab them like upwards of 30 times. Sometimes he would violate the victims, if you catch my drift there. And sometimes he would brutally mutilate or decapitate body parts or heads and leave them in these horrible positions and poses for someone else to come and find. That's pretty much the story of him. He got caught. And like you said, he's a total loser.
Yeah, he was executed. But one of the fascinating things about his case was that right before he was executed, he admitted to a series of other murders that had gone unsolved. There was a family that was killed, and the MO was shockingly similar to his.
Yeah.
And people were on the fence about whether or not he had actually done it, or if he was just, because sometimes serial killers will try to take credit for other murders just to sort of like up their like kill count,
the clout.
Yeah. And but he knew things about the murders that weren't public knowledge.
Yeah.
So it's pretty, he was never tried for them or anything. He was executed before any of this could be like investigated, but it's pretty well accepted that he was the murderer of the three members of this family. And I believe it was Louisiana, I think.
Do you know what year it was?
It was before his killing spree. So like late 80s.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't come across that. I came across him singing before he was executed.
What did he sing?
I just saw the headline. I should have read the story. But I found a better article on him, and I went with that article instead. But do you happen to know, I don't know why I'm asking this anymore. hey Phil, what movie did he inspire?
Famously enough, his story obviously the details are completely different and the characters are completely different. Everything's completely different. But he inspired the original screenplay of Scream, Kevin Williamson, to write. He was one of the inspirations for Kevin Williamson to write Scream.
Yeah.
The notion of a killer, a serial killer who wants fame. Mm-hmm. Based on their actions.
Yeah, and the MOs aren't entirely similar, but like Ghostface he kills people with knives, he stabs them to death. The thing that kind of rang true to me in terms of Scream was oftentimes Ghostface would put the bodies in a way that was for shock value.
Yeah.
Danny did here, and he was kind of cavalier almost, because with one of the victims he got into their apartment when they weren't home and just like sat around and pretended like it was his place, like totally cocky, and then she showed up and he murdered her.
Yeah.
So but that's him. Have I missed anything on Daniel Harold Rowling?
Just that if you look him up, he has the saddest face of any serial killer I've ever seen. Like every picture of Danny Rowling, he's got like these enormous worried eyebrows and the sad mouth. Like he looks like a sad, sad child in every single picture.
That's good.
Yep, I mean he should be sad. I'm not saying he shouldn't be, but it's the weirdest thing. Like he has resting sad face.
I've never heard that before. It's a good description of him, though. Do you want to move on to Alexander Sawney Bean?
Yeah, that's a yes. That's a yes.
So he is a little bit of a legend, as you have also alluded to. This one will be pretty short. Alexander, we'll just call him Alexander. We'll call him Alex. We're on a
first
name basis.
Why not call him Sonny? Sonny's a great name.
That's
Sonny's
so hard
a wonderful
for me to
name.
Say. Like my mouth has a hard time forming that. Sonny.
Sonny.
Sonny. That is a good name. Anyway, he was in a clan with 47 other people. It was 48 people large. And he was the leader of this clan of quote-unquote cavemen in the 1500s. They're located in Scotland. And this is kind of where the whole legend piece comes into it. There's supposedly two documents saying that he existed. There was a one birth record in Scotland, and then there was another report of the clan's murders in the newspaper at the time, and still historians don't really know if he ever existed.
Right.
And if he did, all of the claims are probably greatly exaggerated, because the I lost my train of thought. Because the clan, supposedly they were a cannibalistic clan, and they were largely incestuous, so a lot of people said that they kind of look mutated, for lack of a better term. Like, if you... I typed in Alexander Sani Bean into Google, and the first thing that comes up is, like, a caveman-esque human with, like, a very bulbous forehead and, like... like a big jaw.
Yeah.
But they were cannibals, and they reportedly were responsible for more than 1,000 murders throughout the 1500s.
That's a lot of murders.
That's a lot, which I think that's fair to call into question whether they actually killed 1,000 people. I've tried to lay hints for our audience if they can try to guess what movie they inspired, but I assume that you already know, Phil.
I assume that what I'm thinking is what you are intending. Should I guess?
Yes, go for it.
Is it The Hills Have Eyes?
That is correct.
Hooray!
The Hills Have Eyes, which... is another movie I own, but I have never seen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, the Legend of Sani... I mean, it's funny, because when you talk about The Legend of Sani Bean, it's so all-encompassing that you almost believe it could have happened, because it sounds plausible. Like, it's the middle of, like, it's you know, like the 1500s. Yeah. So people, you know, we know that there were highwaymen. We know that there were clans of thieves that lived out in wooded areas. We know that people did die a lot when they were out and about. Out doing their own thing. It's just
there's still like a few details that just make it sound very far-fetched.
Well, what happens is like these stories would get propagated and reprinted and retold by newspapers. Well, their version, like broadsheets, basically.
Yeah.
That would get put up because the idea of news at the time was just entertainment. Like, it wasn't like there were proclamations, but there was also just like this notion of like, here's what people should like need to know about, or here's something interesting to keep people diverted.
Mm-hmm.
The Legend of Sani Bean, the story of Sani Bean. We'll just say that it happened a few years ago and put it up on this so people can read it, but not in like the notion of truth versus legend versus reportage versus a story like that. It wasn't like we think about it now, because who cared? Like, it's a good story.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's 500 years ago, which means that there's been a lot of time for manipulation of the story. But either way, still very entertaining.
But I think that Sani Bean has one of the greatest names of legendary. I think Sani Bean and Sweeney Todd are two of, like, the great, like, because in isolation, if you, like, here's a name for you, Sani Bean. You'd be like, that's goofy and sounds like a dumb cartoon character.
Yes.
But then you go, all right, Sani Bean leads a cannibalistic family. And then you're like, oh, that does sound creepy.
Oh, like, tell me more.
Like the cartooniness and goofiness of the name all of a sudden makes him even like more intimidating. Like, Sweeney Todd, well, that sounds like a little boy with a lollipop. And then you're like, no, he was a barber who made people into pies. And you're like, oh
tell me more.
Now Sweeney Todd sounds creepy.
Yeah. So,
I think Sani Bean, the Legend of Sani Bean, part of it is that name, like it just sticks in your head, as hard as it may be to say.
Sani Bean. Since you said he looked goofy, now I just have like the idea of goofy, like Gorsh going around killing people, which is interesting. That's basically the idea of that game that I played, Bendy and the Ink Machine.
I thought you were going to say Kingdom Hearts. That is about Goofy going around killing people. Isn't that what it's about?
That's true, except they're heartless.
Right.
That's a whole other conversation I would love to have.
And no, you're not allowed to use weapons, so he fights with a giant key.
Is that why that is?
That's why he has a key, because they weren't allowed to give him a sword.
Oh, I think I might have known that. I could talk about that all day. Should we move on to the Charles Manson family?
That sounds like fun.
We are all aware. Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So everyone knows who Charles Manson is and his quote-unquote family. He was a lifelong criminal. He spent some time in the music industry, writing songs and whatnot. In the 60s, he formed a cult now known as the Manson family. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the cult was kind of based on the belief that the Beatles song Helter Skelter was actually a prophecy about the impending race war.
That's part of it. That's definitely a part of it. Manson's one of those hard people to research because he created his own mythology around himself. Mm-hmm. Like after he was caught and jailed, he has always been the author of his own legend.
Yeah.
And so what he would say about himself always has to be compared against what really happened. they did a wonderful multi-part report on his story on the podcast, the last podcast on the left. Yeah. And they came up with their conclusion about Charles Manson is the one that makes the most sense to me, which is basically that Charles Manson was a hippie criminal, mm-hmm. who just wanted women and drugs and to not have to do anything. Yes. The only way to get that was to keep his group of people around him. And the only way to do that was to escalate their indebtedness to him. He never wanted to be a murderer, but that was the only way to maintain his position, because he was this tiny little just dirty just scumbag. And
well, yeah, we already call him losers. Like if you look up a picture of him, he looks kind of goofy, and I hate to say he just looked like a dork.
Yeah, he was this dorky little guy, and you're like, oh, like he just wanted people around him. Mm-hmm. And so he just kept he just kept escalating this thing that eventually resulted in murders and mayhem and basically the death of the dream of the 60s.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Fight Club, where it's just like, hey, we're making soap and now we're fighting each other and now we're blowing up buildings.
Right, right.
The Charles Manson family, from what I saw, were involved in several robberies, assaults, breaking and entering. Apparently, they attempted assassination on Gerald Ford, who was president at the time, and at least 8 murders. The one instance that inspired the movie, though, took place in 1968. It involved an actress by the name of Sharon Tate and 4 of her friends that were just kind of hanging out at her house at the time, which is incredibly unfortunate. At the time, Sharon Tate was 26 years old, married to a director by the name of Roman Polanski, and was 8.5 months pregnant at the time, which makes this incredibly tragic because she was ready to have a child any time. One night, 4 members of the cult broke into Sharon's house and tied up the 5 occupants. 3 of the members were women, because like you said, Charles Manson just wanted women around him. There was Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, hope I'm saying that right.
Kasabian? Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm always bad with last names. And then Patricia Krenwinkel. And they were, in this incident, they were led by a man named Tex Watson. Mm-hmm. In the internet age, it's hard not to say Tex Watson. but he basically told the women, and I quote him here, totally destroy everyone in the house as gruesome as you can. And the only reason I could find as to why he said that is because someone that they didn't like used to live in that house.
Right.
They didn't have any evidence that that person didn't live there anymore. Otherwise, they may have not done this. But they broke into the house. They tied everyone up. Before they entered the house, they climbed a telephone pole and cut the telephone line so that no one could call out. People, as they're tied up, would start to escape, and then they'd get stabbed to death. The people getting tied up didn't really know what was going on, so they tried giving them money, and they still didn't go away. And eventually, all of the victims were either beaten or brutally stabbed or shot to death. Do you have any idea what film this inspired?
This is the one where I'm like, I am not quite sure which movie you're pulling. So I'm going to let you answer this one because I'm not sure which one you're talking about.
Well, apparently the writer for this movie was inspired by several just like breaking and entering stories from when they were a kid, and compounded with the story, this specific story of the Manson family, ended up writing The Strangers, which was a 2008 film.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of things shared within that movie, like they cut the telephone line, they broke into their house, they're just kind of generally torturing them without saying what they're doing. So kind of the same general theme going on.
Now, have you seen The Strangers?
I have not.
You have not seen The Strangers.
But I read a synopsis.
Well, it's interesting because I think that The Strangers, I think that Hills Have Eyes, I think that all these movies are talking about Psycho. Mm-hmm. What they do is they build a level, like a layer of unknowability and mystery and fascination with mm-hmm. these killers that is bluntly unearned, like in real life. Like the Tate LaBianca murders were the results of a charismatic leader telling his undereducated assistants and followers to go murder some people.
Yeah.
And so they did in the sloppiest way possible. Mm-hmm. And you know, if Sonny Bean existed, I guarantee you they weren't a bunch of monsters like they were in Hills Have Eyes. They were just a bunch of highwaymen and robbers. And Ed Gein wasn't Norman Bates. He was just this lonely guy living out in the middle of nowhere mm-hmm. who was trying to rebuild his mother.
Yeah.
But he wasn't anything like you wouldn't have stood out in a crowd. And when you get these movies based on these killers and word gets out that, oh, the strangers, is fascinating because who are these strangers? We don't know. All we know is they come and they go and they leave mayhem in their wake. But that's not what the Manson family was. They were a bunch of burnouts who were just doing whatever this little troll in the desert told them to do.
That's exactly right. And for better, probably worse, it makes living a little bit scarier than it should be.
Right.
Because, I don't know how many times people have told me, oh, my favorite horror, the horror movies that really get me are the ones about, home invasion. Home invasion ones are the ones that always get me. And it's not like this. It's not like The Purge or you're not going to wake up. This is a totally different tangent, but you're not going to wake up with your head in a reverse bear trap. Like, that's just not what happens.
And I hope you're not.
Well, yes. And that's what scares people. Which I guess the moral of the story is, yes, there are serial killers out there, but they're all just losers.
They're all just losers. And the big one that from the last year or so was the Golden State Killer, mm-hmm. the Irons killer. And to me, he was the most terrifying one because he got away with it for so long. He had so many victims, just innumerable victims. And they just kept discovering that, oh, it wasn't just these two serial killers. Those were the same guy. Then it wasn't these three people. That was all this one guy.
Yeah.
He's the one who stands out to me as I can't believe he got away with it for this long. But again, he only did because he was, he was an ex-cop. So he kind of knew the ins and outs. But also, he was operating in so many different jurisdictions over so long a period. And in the 70s and 80s, there was no communication between jurisdictions. They never put two and two together. It wasn't that he was some mastermind so much as the system did not exist to catch a person like that, which is why they say you just don't see as many serial killers these days. It's not because there are fewer people with those impulses. It's because killers tend to get caught sooner before they escalate.
Before there's a spree.
Right. You get one murder and, we found the DNA. We've matched it with someone in the database. We know who it is.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that there's not. Obviously, there are enough serial killers out there right now, and they are operating, and it is frightening. But that's just they aren't these figures of legend. They are anomalies, and they're not worthy of respect or because I know there's serial killer fans out there.
Well, they're almost romanticized, which is kind of disgusting.
It is, yes.
I used to listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, and this is something that comes up a lot. You get the people that write to prisoners just because they get off on that, and that's almost. I shouldn't say it's almost as disgusting, but it's still disgusting.
Right.
That they validate these people for the horrible things they've done.
Right, right. And the takeaway is they're not special people. Mm-hmm. They are aberrations, and what they do isn't part of what makes a society healthy. And
right.
And they should be caught and incarcerated and. If you want to study them, if you want to learn about them, learn about the fact that they are people who just got lucky and not these pinnacles of human evolution.
Right.
They're not Hannibal Lecter. Hannibal Lecter is a fictional character. There are no gentleman serial killers out there. Yeah. There are no refined serial killers.
They're all losers.
They're all selfish and losery, and they have bad impulse control, and that's how they should be known.
Dexters or
it's serious. Yeah, they're not supervillains.
Yeah.
Ugh.
They're just disgusting. I'm so glad you went on that rant, Phil. They are disgusting, and I couldn't have said it better myself. Should we take a quick break, and then when we get back, I wanna see what some of your favorite horror movies are, if that's okay.
Let's do it.
All right.
Mother, My mother, what is the phrase? She isn't quite herself today.
Well, listeners, thank you for joining us for this special October month episode. If you want to interact with us, you can do so at all the normal places like Facebook. You can help vote on what you want to hear next. You can leave us reviews. But where can people find you, Phil?
You can find me, if you're just looking for my podcast, you can find any of them wherever you find podcasts. Deep in Bear Country, It's Del Toro Time, or Click It Cast. There's no central hub for them, but just search for them on your podcast listener, and they will pop up.
Yes. Or you can look on Nextdoor for Phil.
Right. Go to the Nextdoor Twitter feed every few months. Jen Takahashi, who runs Best of Nextdoor, will repost a really weird Nextdoor post that I did announcing the Berenstain Bears podcast that always gets a strange turnout on the Best of Nextdoor feed.
There's a lot of reactions.
Let's just say.
But yeah, go check out his podcast. We've talked about it before, and John and I have been on his podcast before, and it's always a hoot.
It was a hoot.
The podcast is always a hoot, though, I will say that. So not just when we're on it, also when other people and just yourself are on it, it's also a hoot.
Thank you.
So go check those out. Before we close up shop today, I'm curious.
Yes.
If you had to suggest like one or two horror movies to myself and our listeners to creep ourselves out this October, what would you suggest?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. There's so many different kinds of horror movies and levels of horror movies and points of horror movies.
Yeah.
That I could just, well, literally I could spend all day talking about this.
You could do a whole podcast about it.
I could literally, you could probably, if anyone ever out there is ever interested in starting a podcast about horror movies, think about it. Someone should do that one of these days.
Yeah.
We've covered quite a few horror movies on It's Del Toro Time. I'm going to go ahead and throw out just a couple of titles here of ones that are really stuck with me that I have watched recently. A couple that might not seem like horror when you first think about them, but that examine horrific aspects of life and our lives and the way people interact with one another. I want to recommend the movie Nightmare Alley, starring Tyrone Power, directed by Edmund Goulding. It's a noir film about a carnival sideshow psychic who becomes rich and famous, but the movie itself is extraordinarily strange. It is about kind of the depravity of the human soul. It's very dark. It goes down some pretty nightmarish alleys.
Appropriately.
And it is a just knock your socks off film noir. It's scary in the sense that it overturns some ugly leaves about as far as human behavior goes.
Yeah. Awesome.
So Nightmare Alley is one. The next one I'm going to recommend, if you haven't watched it in a while and you're looking for a classic movie about the horror of, and it's going to sound weird when I say it, the horrors that humanity can bring upon itself, I am going to recommend you go and you rewatch the original 1954 film of Godzilla.
Oh, really?
Gojira. It's readily available on DVD and Blu-ray. We just rewatched it, and the horrors of a movie made in post-war Japan about the horror of nuclear war and nuclear annihilation and the way humanity can wipe itself out. It's easy to forget going into Godzilla that Godzilla is not the focus of the movie.
About humanity.
It's really about the people. It's about the horrible things we've created and the way we visit destruction upon ourselves. In our attempts to advance in the world, I recommend the movie Godzilla. Just go out, get the 1954 Gojira, Godzilla, and give it a watch. Absent all the movies that came after it.
yeah. Well, you're saying the one with Matthew Broderick isn't like a crowning moment.
Right.
In the series?
Don't think of it as like this is. Don't think of it as the first in a series of rubber suit movies. Think of it as the horror movie it was when it was created, and that's why I'm recommending Godzilla.
I love it. I don't think I've ever seen the original. So.
Oh, watch it! It's so good.
I got both of these pulled up on my Google searches so that I can remember to track them down. But thank you for those recommendations. If you want to hear Phil talk more about horror movies, go do so. And then if you are so inclined, join us next week. I believe that we're talking more, a little bit about movies. We're talking about the Warrens, who were made famous in the Conjuring universe.
Yes.
We're gonna
if you want to talk about
them.
If you want to talk about movies that have built the reputation of people who don't deserve that reputation,
that'd be the Warrens.
There's the Warrens. There's my commentary. Take it with you.
Perfect. Take it into next week.
Yeah.
But until then, I'm still Nick.
Am I supposed to say something?
We never tell our guests, but you're supposed to say, I'm still Phil.
Oh, I'm still Phil.
And this is Stranger Still.
I give you the incredible flying machine.